want to welcome everyone tonight. This is our second talk on wise livelihood, which is a part of the Eightfold Path, which is a part of the Four Noble Truths, which is a part of the Buddha's teaching. Okay, so that's the talk. I think it's real important for us not to lose sight of what this whole thing is about. We're trying to end conflict and struggle, often called dissatisfaction, disorientation, or suffering in our life. And we looked and have looked at how that was formed, the causes of it. And now we're looking at ways that we can orient our life so that that can be eliminated, so that life can live itself free of that disentanglement, that contraction, that resistance that seems almost inherent within the form and posture of life that most of us take. And unless we look at all aspects of our living experience in terms of how we engage in a very resistant and struggling way, we leave out a great deal of the difficulty. And certainly I don't think is a topic that's more worthy of our spending time on than wise livelihood. It's rare to find anyone who is completely oriented in a heartfelt and spiritual direction in their life, or that their life is really working for them in terms of wise livelihood, that there's a fallout somewhere, a disengagement, a cutoff. Sometimes it's in family life, sometimes it's in work life, sometimes it's in other forms of the engaged process. But wherever it is, we have to go there. We can't just ignore it or pretend that the problem doesn't exist and hope we die before we have to take it on. That's what real integrity is that honesty, that orientation that says, okay, you know, I have some things to look at here. And I was speaking last time about integration at work, integrity at work. We have to keep that integrity basic to our life. Basic integrity, honesty, self-honesty, perceptual life, a life oriented to open-heartedness and engaged activity, interrelatedness, bringing the interconnected wise view to bear on our livelihood. But we can't hold our livelihood to standards that we ourselves don't practice. And many of us only want the most refined job, and we have an idealism about our work that doesn't hold true to even our lifestyle. And so it's important for us to understand that the way we live are the jobs that we're going to be taking, that those jobs manufacture the very products that our comfort level sustains at home and off the work. So to be realistic in terms of the jobs we do take. But that doesn't mean that we don't carry a standard of integrity with us when we are on the job, or that we don't ask our job some standards from our job, so that the job doesn't obviously cause harm in the world, intentionally cause harm in the world, but that all work in some ways is going to be harmful to the world if you do nothing else but drive from one home to the other, you're wasting gas and all the different ways that of excess that any job has will also be on the job that we take. But you know, there are only a few that the Buddha pointed out and I spoke about last time that were obvious jobs that the intention was in the job to harm life. Not that harm didn't somehow extend itself in the running of the work, the excessive resources, etc., but that the job itself did not aim towards harm. Like one of his things was in terms of slavery, We're not in the slave market here, hopefully. So that the work has value, and that we have value in it. And then a greater question is, of course, how do we make this spiritual-based? How do we make our job spiritual-based? We're not asking that everyone has service jobs that are working with the homeless or the needy. Not at all. In fact, the more important a facet of the work experience for us to take on is not to ask, how do I serve, how does my job serve humanity in the greater sense of that? But rather, am I interested? Where's my interest, my passion in my work? Because the passion itself will serve humanity. And if we artificially induce a job on us because we think that's what a good spiritual person should be doing, perhaps going out and working with the homeless, then we won't be necessarily interested in that at all. We're just doing it as a should. And the worst thing you could ever do in your spiritual life is to operate from a should or a must. It's so obvious when you think of it that life, the place that life is, where you most easily touch life is where you're most interested in it. That's where you're most interconnected. So it's not necessary to find a job beyond what your natural interests incline you towards. And that may be astronomy, maybe looking in through a microscope. So don't start thinking of work as being necessarily only spiritual work. That's necessarily spiritual is work that has some sort of human service component to it. That's not right. But then once we take on a job, how is it with our interests? Some of us, if we're fortunate, please, I understand that most of us find our ways into work because we have to work and they're not interesting. It's not what we're really interested in anyway. But if we're fortunate to find a job or take a job in which we are interested, how is it that all of a sudden, after a certain length of time, we become disengaged? But we no longer show up for our work, you see? And is that about our work at all? Or is it say much more about our relationship to the work and what we're bringing to the work? Because disengagement happens after a time to most of us at some point in our work life. And we feel, it's like we sort of self-implode on the job. And perhaps people have formed an opinion of us, or we of the people, or somehow we hadn't marched forward in our ranks the way we had thought or anticipated or hoped. Or maybe we weren't acknowledged or something. But somehow there can be a kind of growing discontent and disgruntlement and despair on the work. And we're no longer showing up for it. 8 hours or more. And we're no longer showing up for our life. Now this is problematic. This is problematic. And it's not problematic for the job. It's problematic for each one of us. Because it's not okay for a spiritual seeker to disorient, have no spiritual orientation to a third of their life. It's not okay. That's not going to work for you on your behalf. Now how can I wake myself back up to this thing? How can I re-engage? How can I show up again? How can I dust off the preconceived notions I have of it and my attitudes? Because somehow an attitude has blunted an exuberance that perhaps once was there but is no longer. And I have to re-engage with that community of workers in a way that brings forth my heart again. Now that heart can be engaged through the value system of the job, or it can be engaged through just the relationship of those co-workers. And we can, but whatever it is, we're going to have to work very difficult to recover ourselves within it. And it really requires a lot from us, besides the knowledge base that we bring to do the work. It brings out a total responsibility of personhood to be on a job. We're not just there as doctor, nurse, social worker, or tech. We're there as a human being. And it's through our humanness that that re-engagement can be established and our heart can be reconnected. But are we willing to do that? Or do we just bypass that, you see, and disengage from our work and hope to find fulfillment in our home life? Or is it the opposite of that? We have no home life and we find ourselves fully trying to engage totally on the job. I had one coworker had no family life and would spend 10, 12 hours at the hospice because their hospice was her family. Well, that's not healthy. That's not healthy. And then there are people that disengage from both their family life and their work. And that's probably the majority of us, really. And find the only place that we can find true satisfaction with the TV. Disengaging, showing up is inherent in what we're teaching here, what we're learning here. And so, and there's no moment that prohibits that. It's only us, each of us, that prohibit that showing up. And it's because of something, and we have to look for that, the cause of that. Where is it that we're backing away? What is it that's going on here? Asking that question already, we have to show up. Just asking that question, posing that question to ourselves. You see, the question itself rallies the truths here. Don't be afraid to ask those very difficult questions. And another component part of spiritual-based work is in looking not in terms of the competition. I sometimes think we spend too much time in this culture with the entrepreneur spirit and focus and the private enterprise motivation instead of looking at the whole here. Instead of looking at the whole, the product and how it serves the whole. If you look at that, the purchase of that product will be self-evident. In hospice care, you get so enraptured with this idea of being the best that in hospice that was brought forward. So here we were, right? And we had more patients coming onto our service than we could handle in any particular time. So I would say, okay, well, let's send the patients that aren't being served. Admit to hospice X, Y, or Z. Oh, no, we can't do that. We shouldn't do that. I said, why shouldn't we? Because that's our competition. I said, nonsense. These are dying people. But and pretty quickly they would orient to that, understand. But that... The immediate response is, you know, not in terms of who we're serving and what the service we're providing and the need for that continuity of, but, you know, is our hospice being the best? Can we, you know, all of that sort of jostling around. Or should we find some way to better serve the patient? Nobody wants to tell the other hospices about. What I would do again, just keep the focus on what we're doing. Do it the best you can. Share it with everyone, and our service will stand. That's all that is necessary to bring more patients in. If you operate any more in a kind of a deceitful attitude, the deceit is what people feel, and nobody's going to give a sick, dying patient to a hospice that has a reputation for deceit. Whoa. But I think that's true of all, I think it's true of all products. I think it's true of all products. I really do. You know, there's just so much of this kind of protection of ideas from one another. And we lose the sense of being, we're serving humanity. We're serving life. And it doesn't matter what we're doing. Again, it doesn't have to be service work in order for that service to tie in at all. So there's another, I'm just picking it apart a little bit here. Another component of spiritual-based livelihood is what I call compartmentalized timing. We compartmentalize ourselves. Now, there can be no spiritual flow across partitions. And most of us have partitions within ourselves. You know, this is my time at work. And this is my time driving to work, and now this is my time driving to home, and this is my time at home, and work time, home time, family time, private time. None of it flows together. And if one extends over into the other, then somebody gets upset about it. So if I'm at doing my private meditation, so this is my personal time, and a phone rings, and it's the job, and I get very angry that they're interfering, or because the compartmentalization. Where's the compartmentalization of time? Why isn't it all my time? You see, if it's all our time, we wait to get away from that which is not ours. If it's all ours, then we don't wait to get away from anything. I'm not suggesting workaholics here. I'm suggesting the free movement and flow across boundaries, perceived boundaries. And then this feeling of it all being my time. This is my time at work. This is my time with my children. This is time for me at work. This is time for me with my children. This is time for me by myself. And if those happen to mix, this is time for me by myself, and in come my children. Now it's time for me with my children by myself. And the upsetness comes from the rigidity of those boundaries, of those partitions, doesn't it? Where is that in life? Somebody show that to me, because I don't see it. I don't see that. And you look at how we live our life throughout the day, it's very much like that. This doesn't meet my expectation. I didn't want this to happen. It was all, what does that have to do with anything? Where was that written? That this was going to be according to your manual. And that pressure of time that we feel, that pressure of time, it's not just compartmentalized time, but the pressure of time. Sometimes somehow it bears down on us, doesn't it? Now you show me where time bears down on you. How could that possibly happen? How could you feel hurried? Where is that? I want to spend the majority of the talking about that sense of stress, busyness, and burnout. Because it's so prevalent. It's just, you see, so what's burnout? I define it this way. When the demands we make upon ourselves exceeds our ability for self-renewal. Someone said that burnout is repressed anger. And it is. And so let's just look at burnout, because it's a word that's used quite frequently, especially in service-oriented fields. But any job can contain it. If you're too focused on work and nothing else, when we're too focused on one aspect of life at the exclusion of all else, then there's going to be an overextension. It's not going to be balanced. a balanced life. One of the first questions I would ask a potential employee that was coming to work in hospice is, you know, tell me about the rest of your life. I'm not really interested in why you're here. It's obvious why you're here. But tell me about the rest of your life. If I didn't hear a balanced formula of exercise and just a good, healthy lifestyle, balanced with relationship or interactive quality, I knew it wouldn't last. The person was coming overbearing on death, and you can easily do that in death and dying. You can overbear on it. You know, you can bear down on it too strong. Your ego grabs it with the same tension that it grabs its own mortality, and it becomes a salvation, a savior complex in that. So that sense of that work above all else. See, when it's that way, you lose your creative edge. Or another one is the romanticization of a job, where you hear that in the potential employee too. You know, where they romanticize what it means to work with a dying. So I would tell the nurse to take this person out and make sure they emptied the bedpan, just to ground them in the realities of the work. Not this, you know, because when people come into it like that, and I'm just using what I'm familiar with, but you can use your job also. It may not have a dramatic subject like death and dying, but it has the same capacity for romanticization, for idealization. You know, that fighting of the pain of the world. You know, I'm going to come here and I'm going to keep you from ever feeling pain. Well, good luck. That sense, if I just work hard enough, anything is possible. You see, I want no part of someone like that. Because in that logic, they're coming to end that person's suffering for them. If they just work hard enough, they can keep that person from dying, maybe. See, that's a person who has no self-understanding. You look for earmarks of ways that people self-understand when you approach important subjects, like your job. Or rigid perfectionism. Another sure sign of burnout at some point is rigid perfectionism. Unrealistically high standards and expectations on themselves and on work life of their coworker. That's a sure sign in almost every single field, even if you're self-employed. That's a doomsday scenario for you. Perfectionism. And what I don't understand the wink this culture gives perfectionism. Like, I'm perfectionistic. Oh, you know, like, that's really good. That's what we're saying, that it's good to be perfectionist. It's not good to be perfectionistic. It's not realistic. It's not even oriented in the proper line. I mean, that's not the way life is. Life is messy. Death is messy. It's all over the place. It's just messy. You come back, you listen in one of these team meetings, and it's just messy. You know, the son didn't show up, and the husband was drunk, and the patient fell out of bed, and, you know, it's like just messy. And then on to the next patient. You do the best you can with it. There's a beautiful Buddha's quote I just think that I want to insert here. Because perfectionism or idealism is really, it's anger. And compassion is the sustaining quality of consciousness, said the Buddha. Anger is not. He says, like a forest fire, anger burns out its own source. So the right orientation is the heart. And it's not just, again, I want to just reinforce it. It's not in hospice work. It's in every line of business. Where's the heart in this? Where's my, and it's not outside of your passion. It's not outside of your interest. It's within that. It's within the interconnectedness of how the interest brings you into the world to show you the life lived through that interest. And you can be a city planner. It doesn't have a function. That's why the Buddha kept it so wide open when asked about wise livelihood. He didn't have 223 jobs you must not do. He just said, make sure that the work doesn't have an intentional harm. That's all. And then go out and fully show up for the work you're in. Bring your interest forward and find out why you can't, because that's the difficulty. Not with the job. It's with our incapacity in that moment to realize the pain of how we're holding that job. And the final component of burnout that I would just like to mention tonight is that the person which I saw so much of is that kind of martyr complex on the job, that they'll do anything, you know, for the job. And sometimes not writing down the number of miles to the patient's home because the kind of martyr syndrome. Too strong of an identification with the job. That image of me coming in. You know, and especially with some charged professions that I'm familiar with. Again, it can be any profession. If it, like with the nurse, you see, that was a, you know, the nurse is an intricate and intimate part, of course, of that patient's care. But when they start circling the bed so that no other team member could get in, because if they knew how to do it all, then that was when they needed a talking to. You know, the wise staff person would back away and say, would bring in, I want the chaplain in here, I want the social worker, I want two volunteers, and that, like that, and the home health aid, get them out there. And then you knew that they were acting appropriate for their profession and the job. But when somebody circled the bed and limited any access, didn't call in any help, you know, there is this possessive factor. Sure sign of burnout. Absolutely. It's quite a question, who are you? Are you a nurse first? This is a human, the beauty of, again, I'm just using hospice as a representation, as an example. The interdisciplinary team represented facets of that patient care. So we had a social worker for the social component and economic component of the patient's life, chaplain for the spiritual component, the nurse for the physical care, home health aide for the personal care, volunteer for the social care, all of those. So when you looked at the team members, each represented a different facet of the total human being. So you'd want to call them all in. A total human being dies as a total human being, to bring all those people together. So who are we, you see? First of all, in our job, who are we? What are we? That questioning doesn't end on the cushion. It goes through our day, goes through our life. And wherever we're causing or inflicting a kind of enclosed fence of protection, what's going on there? I mean, that should be the first thing that a spiritual student asks who's serious. What am I doing here? What's going on? Why? What's the tightness about? So that leads me to the next thing I want to bring forth, and that's stress. The stress. Stress and busyness. Stress is just, I mean, there are lots of legitimate reasons that we feel under the pressure that we feel. And one of the legitimate reasons is the productivity standards that we're faced in this culture. And it's kind of a system of our own making, because our wages are higher than in most parts of the world, and now the world is an international market. So they can work for X number of dollars leisurely, but for us to be able to compete, we have to work twice as long at the dollar rate that we have. And so the productivity standards are just being steeped on us here, just to stay competitive in the world and not lose the salary rate that we already have. And yet, it's wearing people down almost to a nub. And another wink that goes on here, and especially those of you in the technological field, like Microsoft employees and people like that, where the expectation is that you're going to work 10 or 12 hours a day. That's the expectation. Now, it doesn't say that in your contract, because that's illegal to say that in your contract. But if you don't, you don't go anywhere. And you know that. And so then that's the expectation going in, that you'll have no home life, really. And so already those productivity standards, the work relationship to your life is disproportional. And then you can get into a job, and it doesn't have to be, it can be any job can get tedious after a while with that constant problems with no creative solutions. I think sometimes teachers, where you have the grade, same grade year after year, and you've got the lesson plan from the previous year that you can apply to the forthcoming year, and you do that 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 10 years in a row, and nothing new comes from you, nothing creative. It's easy to keep applying the same lessons plans year after year, but it wears you down. The sameness of life wears you down. I couldn't do that in Dharma talks. I can't keep giving you the same talks, because if I'm not alive giving the talk, first of all, if I'm not alive in my life, it's not worth living for me. And if I'm not alive in my talk, what am I saying to you? I mean, reproduce what I'm asking you to do if I'm sitting up here going, and then the second thing is, and the third. Yeah. So there needs to be some liveness here. So to understand what it is that we're carrying, and why it is, what it is they're carrying. Is there a way? Yes, it's very difficult to keep bringing new lesson plans and being creative. But that is the stretching that's necessary for the Dharma to be there. We have to stretch up. And sometimes the problems of our life keep us very condensed, down, impacted in ourselves. And we don't want to stretch up creatively because we don't feel like we have the energy. Well, what's that about? What's happening in our family life that feels so, disorienting and offsets our energy to such a degree? See, all these things, just that basic first and second noble truth, you go towards the difficult. Because if you don't, it affects everything. It's a system that has to be in balance all the way through it. All the way through it. If there's any dysfunctionality anywhere in there, and we're talking about 8 hours, it's not a small amount of dysfunctionality. Everything becomes dysfunctional. Livelihood's a huge... It's not just, go out and do good. No, you have to, fully alive. What's going on here? Always questioning, looking, seeing what's going on in oneself. And this enormous need we have to stay busy. If I can just merge into that. Now that's one. I fully own this one. I mean, I'm learning more about my own need to be busy than I ever have, because it has such a compelling payoff to it, from my point of view. Being busy, you know. And again, for me, it's those old scripts that I continue to run with about, I don't remember, an idle child is, I don't know, whatever that saying is, something about, devils, you'll be a devil, basically. And just the sense if I'm as busy as I am, I must really be needed in life. That's the extrapolation of it. So, hello, yes? Wait a minute, I'm on my BlackBerry. And the pager goes off, you know, it's like... Good Lord. Oh, good Lord. But it loses its reason. It loses its motivation. That's what's so insidious about some of these component parts of the mind, is that whatever it is that we invested in, I mean, I'm aware enough to know that facet of busyness. But busyness has long since left that motivation. That may have been the initial reason I was busy, is to feel powered and all that kind of stuff. But now it's just being busy because I'm used to it. Just the conditionality of that and the addicted quality of having the endorphins at that racing that high in our system. It's no longer, you see, it's, so then it becomes busyness for busyness' sake. That's really when it gets out of control. So I'm on my 2-minute toothbrush. I'm learning a lot from that 2-minute toothbrush. The thing goes on and I'm like, can I finish in time? And then the thing, you know, it's like, and what, it's as if it really matters that I have to get my teeth brushed in that 2-minute thing. It doesn't matter. I know that. But emotionally, it matters. And I'm going, oh. It is amazing. But that's just a symptom of the busyness that's there all the time. It's not about brushing the teeth, but you can feel that sense of response to time, responsiveness to time. So we're going to do a whole series on time for my benefit. So I want to talk a little bit about some of the counter ways to move through this. Because when we stay so busy, we've lost the context of something. We've lost our proper relationship to things. We're moving pell-mell through things. And you lose the contextual environment in which things are arising. And there's no space to busyness. There's no space because it's just one, it's thought streaming that has led to busyness. So it takes a tremendous renunciation. And I use that word deliberately because that's what it requires. It takes a tremendous, tremendous willingness of heart to just pause. Because that's the last thing each cell that has been driven to the point of manic wants to do. And that's it. Okay, this is it. And that pause, that space, giving life space in that pause. What happens in that pause is that you have options. There are no options from busyness. There's just the next rung. And there is understanding. Only in space is there understanding. This whole Dharma rests upon our ability to understand what it is that's happening to us. Not to follow ritualistically or scripturally what has been dictated to us. And there's no way to access understanding unless the context of the environment is completely seen, the orientation. Another way to invite space is to ask questions about the motivating, driven quality of the lack of it. So when you're busy, you ask questions about that. What's behind this driving urge? What's happening here? What's going on? So you ask questions about it. Suddenly you have space around it. If it's an assumption, you see, the reality we live with is not where we like our questions to come from. We don't like our questions to come, we like them to come from the reality we live, not about the reality we're living. See? Questions coming from the reality would be, how can I speed up even quicker to get more done? Questions about the reality we're living are questions about speed itself and the need to be so hurried. Look at the reality we're assuming, the pattern that we have lived with, and ask questions about it, not from it. That driven mind, it's not conscious. It's being pressured, but it's not conscious. There's no consciousness of the pressure. It doesn't realize that the sense of drive itself is coming from its own need. It's not being pressured from the outside. It's being pressured from its own inadequacy, really. If you look at what it is and why it is that we are under so much, that we drive ourselves, it's often because of a sense of lacking, that we're trying to get over that lacking so that nobody can perceive it through the products and productivity that we're offered. And it's the lacking that creates the pressure. Nothing from the outside can pressure us. Not if we're willing to see it. Who's forcing this? Who's forcing it? And what's the payoff I get? This addicted feeling that I get. Just a couple of practical suggestions. When we feel so seriously driven in our life, so busy, so compartmentalized in time, it's fun to kind of play with that a little bit. I found it very helpful for me sometimes when I see myself in a pattern, like busyness, to exaggerate that until I smile. So just by myself, I will get even busier. And I'll force myself to be frenetic until finally I go, a smile breaks on my face. And that kind of exaggerated performance allows me to see that this is the humor of it, gives me space to it. Play with the feeling a little bit. In fact, just playing, period. More play in our life. More nonsensical play. Non-deliberate play. Not play. When I was a kid, we would just call each other up and go have a basketball game. Now everything's so darn organized, you know, that it's all so regimented. But that, I don't mean regimented play, I mean just fun play. Like just having fun. And many of us don't know how to do that anymore. Another thing I found to be very helpful, especially when we feel that sense of being driven, because when we're driven, it's more, the urge is it takes precedent to the planning, to the methodical. Thank you. The methodical. You have to have the dictionaries close at hand these days. But the methodical way, okay, let me just plan this out. Rather than just diving into it in some kind of frantic way, let me just methodically plan this thing out. So you plan the activity and you move through it with some deliberation and some slowness. Okay, so this is what I'm going to do today. I'm going to do this and this. And then as situations arise which compete for that, that's okay. Then you have to make the plan flexible enough so that it has some contingencies. But what we're doing is just building space. We're just building space into our life, into our job life, into our work life, not compartmentalizing our life and separating it anymore from any other aspect of our life. This is one life. It's not only one life we're living, it's one life that all of us are living together. We're all in this together, much more than you might invite interpretation of that phrase. We're all in this together in very, very subtle ways. Now, when are we going to wake up to that fact if it's not on our job? Are we just going to follow the enculturated response of competition and bigness? Or can we invite a more considerate, spacious approach? Getting our job done, being proficient, being knowledgeable, but not losing our way within all of that. That's my hope for us all. Thank you. Can we sit for a minute or two? This is really our only, it's a one run, we only get one run at this thing. And many of us are halfway into that run. And some of us are well beyond halfway. So how are you going to run the second half of this? Or maybe you're waiting for retirement. Doesn't change. Okay, any questions or comments about anything this evening? Be happy to. Yes, in the back. Yes.
And idealism.
Yes.
And anger.
Yes. Sure. The question is about perfectionism and anger and idealism and anger. You see, if you're idealistic, or perfectionistic, it's really what are we doing? We feel so shaky inside that what we're trying to do in performance is create the opposite through our performance so that we can't allow or tolerate mistakes, because inside we feel like a mistake. And if we feel like a mistake and we dislike that feeling and our self-image, then I have to, everything I perform, it has to be the opposite of that, so that everyone will be thrown off through my actions, thrown off in what they actually imply. And so when we're so encrusted, when we're so hard on ourselves that our life cannot hold the flexibility of a mistake, which is what life is. It's a continual series of mistakes. And what we have no in mind, we're so calcified in our personal attitude, then we have to look at the way we're holding our image, what we're doing to ourselves, because it's going to play out again and again. If there's anything that I say in these meetings together, is that our inward life plays out in terms of its manifestation, in terms of its interaction, in terms of its job performance, in terms of how it is that we hold life in all aspects of our mind-body experience. And oftentimes, idealism, you know, where you're your expectation of yourself or the situation is such that it doesn't hold, again, a working, interactive, relaxed, that it's, that we think that we can do, if we just apply more, we can get over anything. I mean, that's the, you know, we think that about science, that no matter what the problem is, science will solve it. Well, has anybody looked at the climate these days? Let me see science solve that one in the next 200 years. So, the ideal isn't the real. And when we invest in what is not real, that is an equation for sorrow and pain. I was reading, this is sort of a transgressing point, but I was reading, somebody gave me an article on, they took monks who had sat 10,000 hours, meditators, who, not just monks, but meditators who have sent, and they looked at the front lobe or something of their brain, which is the happiness center, and they compared that to both people who had been meditating just a little bit and people who had not meditated at all. And the people who had 10,000 or more hours of meditation, that's a lot, that happiness center was on fire. And when they interviewed those people, and those who had meditated a little, it was not as much as, of course, a 10,000 hour group, but it was far more than the control group of people who had meditated. But when they talked to those people, the mark, the single mark that was across each of their line was the flexibility in life, how they accommodated life, the non-rigid approach to life. That's the earmark for happiness. That's the, and all of them said, you know, it takes work, it's hard, just like what we're doing here. It's not just, you know, sitting and doing nothing. You really have to examine and look and release and let go. And keep ourselves questioning all the time and see where it is that we are being unconscious to those moments in which we are being brittle and idealistic and perfectionistic. And not just culturally, because they're wink at it inside when we're dying inside from those various causes, but to look with a discerning eye and have only one question. Is this freedom? Is this true? I don't care what culture has to say. My life is the culture. Now, let's see here. Perfectionism. What's going on here? Why do I have to get everything right? And what happens to me when things go wrong? Let me feel the pain of that. Let me go to that place inside. That's how we traverse this thing. Because the culture won't let you out of your cocoon. Yes?
Would you say that when you talk about perfectionism and control, it's an urge that we all have? I see that breaking out of it has correlation with our ability to get into a teaching and into a mentoring mode that allows us expand, and by doing that, actually using that element, it has to be forgiven. There's an element of forgiveness in teaching and in mentoring that naturally allows you to maybe break up some of the perfection that you're...
So you think you pass it on to your students?
Excuse me?
You think the perfectionism in teaching is an attempt to make everybody perfect in their...
No, the other way around.
Oh, I see. Right. So that right. When you start interacting with someone, you can no longer hold to your perfectionistic standards, which is absolutely true because you're dealing with another mind. But that doesn't. But we still do. We still have expectations of other people living up to our ideals, our parents, for instance, which, or anyone, because people are continually disappointing us, aren't they? Why? Because we have an expectation of them that is not being met, and the flexibility and the workability of anyone's life. It's never going to be met. So we do try to maintain a kind of quality of control, we show people how they need to grow. I love that one. You see, this is how, if you had it together, you would just follow my blueprint and be the kind of person that I am. Well, keep that person away from me. Yeah. Yes.
Using a poem by Stafford.
Yes.
Sun shining on your shoes.
Yes. Yes, 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 yes. That's what I wrote. Got it.
Spent 7 hours working today, focused on putting words together in the perfect format.
Yes.
And I walked out of the building, and this woman had this gigantic smile and said, "Isn't it a great day?"
Yes.
And sort of.
Yes. Yes, good. Good.
And that seems like mindful walking or
yes.
Seeing the joy that
I yes, good, beautiful. That's the space, David. That when we bring in space, when we allow ourselves to feel the joy, to feel the pleasures, to be sensitive again, to acknowledge life in all of its, the context of life, the clear comprehension of life, rather than the narrow linear focus of where time takes us and towards the next moment. Then we've regained the spirit of life. We've regained ourselves. We've regained our heart, because it's only our heart that can come out in the expanse rather than in the linear relationship. And so that poem in particular was a good one, because it, you know, a troubling day and my job isn't going well and my wife hates me and all that sort of thing. And then, you know, the sunshine and the soup bubble and the songbird, and all of a sudden, you know, what is it? So what? I mean, you know, so what? The context is always, if you want perfection, it's in the context of the moment. Imperfection is always in the driven quality of this moment to the next. If your life isn't going well, be present. If your life is going well, be present. Okay, good. Thank you all this evening. Yep. Yeah.